You're tuned in to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll meet the new director of the National Symphony Orchestra and talk about his plans for the organization. But first, does D.C. government need to chill out on legislation affecting the bottom lines of local businesses? In the past few years, the D.C. Council has moved legislation pushing up the city's minimum wage and expanding the benefits offered for paid family and medical leave. Now, Council Chairman Phil Mendelson has proposed a moratorium through the end of 2018 on proposals that might negatively affect businesses. Joining us to explore whether businesses truly need a break and how the progressive direction of the D.C. Council is affecting the business climate here in Washington is Yeshim Taylor. She is the founding executive director of the D.C. Policy Center. Yeshim Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also in studio with us is Ed Lazier. He's the director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, a completely different organization. Ed Lazier, thank you for joining us. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Do you own a business in D.C.? How do new local laws affect your bottom line? 800-433-8850. You can send email to Kojo at WAMU.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, KojoShow.org. Join the conversation there. Yeshim, you told the Washington Post this week that you think it's a good idea for the council to hit the pause button for a bit before they take on other issues like requiring employers to give their workers more advance time on scheduling. Why?
I think a moratorium is, it's not a policy, but it's a great strategy to pause and think of some of the implications of the paid leave legislation and minimum wage legislation, and also come up with a way of thinking about the impacts of the other proposals, such as the predictive scheduling or transportation benefits equity amendment act, on not just businesses, but also low-income residents and the workforce in general. The paid leave, for example, the total cost of the program is $260 million. A lot of people will tell you, oh, the district has just implemented a great tax reform package, and it was very good, and it did reduce the burdens on businesses, but the total value of tax reductions on businesses was only $65 million a year. So this would be more than four times the cost. So we've already sort of like made up for the tax reduction. Minimum wage, depending on your ideology, you can, or point of view, you can pick and choose whichever study you want to talk about. Some people will argue it's good, some people argue it's bad, but ultimately, we know the following. A small change is different from a big change in minimum wage. And the bigger the change, the harder the impacts on low-skilled employees and businesses that hire low-skilled employees. So I think we should wait and see what that does.
How would you generally characterize the environment local laws have created for businesses here in the past few years?
I think we see signs of distress. There are very good things about the district's economy that may or may not have to do with local laws, but a growing population, for example, and high-skilled labor that has helped businesses thrive in the city. But we see signs of distress in areas where jobs are growing. For example, hospitality and retail have accounted for more than a quarter of the job growth in the last 10 years. But we see retail employment going down and not recovering. Hospitality, high levels of churn among businesses. We see that high property values and high property taxes are causing businesses to move their middle wage jobs to the suburbs. So we're losing a lot of the sort of like the backbone of middle class jobs, office support jobs and things like that. So a combination of these things are making it hard for businesses to really expand as much as they could.
Ed Lazier, just this past week, census data indicated that D.C. is one of the only urban areas in the country where household income did not go up in the past year. Actually, it went up among whites and it went down among blacks and or people who are non-white. And that was largely responsible for the fact that it in general didn't go up. But how does that inform what you think is necessary for local government to pursue here?
Well, I think it's really important to note that the census data year-to-year changes are really hard to find what's really happening. And so the fact that income was didn't change by a significant margin in 1 year doesn't mean that much, because when we look over a longer period of time, we see a really consistent trend that D.C. is an economic engine, an economic powerhouse, and that incomes are rising overall. When you, if you look back 5, 6, 10 years, just the 1 year change isn't that meaningful. But of course, as you noted, it's not an economic engine that is benefiting everyone. In fact, we know that families are being left behind and that the median Black household income fell by $4,000 and is now less than $40,000. So it's a reminder that as our economy is growing, we have to take conscious efforts to make sure that everybody is benefiting and that a rising tide does not lift all boats. And that's why I'm really concerned that if we say we need a moratorium on things that affect business, what we're really saying is a moratorium on things that will help workers, including those who are being left behind.
William Frey from Brookings said that this data shows us something about the nature of who's coming to local D.C., that young people come here and don't often stay before they take a job or go elsewhere to raise a family, that we, in effect, rent them and don't own them. What do you make of that idea, and how does the council's approach on these issues related to business fit into it? Go ahead.
I mean, it's probably a true point, although I don't really see that. So I live in Brooklyn, and what I'm seeing in the last 10 years are families who are staying. There are so many strollers in every neighborhood in the city. People are staying in the city. The notion that we're just this transient city, I'm not sure, is so accurate anymore. So I think, and I think that actually reflects investments in the quality of life. And I think it's an important point that when we talk about things that help workers, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad for business. So even paid family leave, for example, think about what it will mean to businesses if they are providing paid family leave when suburban businesses aren't, and what that will mean to people who want to work in the city and the attraction of talented employees that will mean for D.C. businesses.
What do you make about what William Frey said?
We have really increased our retention of families, that's true, but the families in the district today do not look like the families that were in the district, say, at the time of Revitalization Act. So our city is losing families east of the river. Our city is losing families that are middle-class families. And our business environment and our policies are not allowing middle-class families and businesses that create jobs for the middle class to really grow and flourish in the city. So this notion that a lot of these regulations on the businesses are there to help the workers, I don't know if it is true for all the workers. It helps some workers, it hurts other workers. A good example is the predictive scheduling. We don't know what it does, except in San Francisco, this has been in place since 2014, and there has been a study surveying retail employers who now, because they are restricted in their scheduling, are offering fewer jobs, fewer hours, and less flexibility for their workers. It doesn't seem like a good outcome to me.
So, Kojo, I have to say, if it's okay just to chime in,
sure.
The reason that Black families are leaving the city is because they can't afford to live here anymore because housing prices are going up and because of the ongoing discrimination that means that they're not benefiting from a growing economy. The notion that it's somehow related to business regulation just doesn't make any sense. We're outperforming the suburbs. Our jobs, the number of jobs in the city is growing faster than in the suburbs, and it's growing faster even in industries dominated by the minimum wage. So the problem is, what can we do to help families afford to live in the city? What can we do to erase barriers to employment? And what can we do to make sure that we have good jobs, including things like benefits like paid family leave?
Well, given her concerns about what is known as the just-in-time scheduling that takes place now and the ideas before the council that would make this kind of scheduling, I guess especially in retail, something that can be more certain about, I guess the argument you're making is see what happens with legislation like this that was passed in other jurisdictions.
Yes.
Before jumping on it here. What would be your response to that, Elizabeth?
We always need to be looking at what the impact is, but I also have to say that when we have anytime there's been an effort to improve the conditions for people working in the city, there's just a fairly large pushback from the business community, even for things like smoke-free DC, which of course turned out to be a huge boon because people want to go to bars and restaurants where there isn't anybody smoking. I think we know that if we have stronger families and families who have stable incomes is what creates stable incomes is what creates stable families. And if someone who's in a retail job where the hours vary from day to day and from week to week, they don't know if they're going to be able to pay the rent. That's not good for stable families. It's actually not good for businesses as well. They want people who are stable. So we obviously need to always look and see what's going to happen when we impose something that affects our economy and affects businesses. But I don't know that we've seen any evidence to suggest at this point that any of these are damaging to our economy.
We're talking about the business climate in Washington, where the chairman of the council, Phil Mendelson, has proposed a moratorium on regulations or legislation that would have a negative effect on businesses through 2018. We're talking with Ed Lazier. He's the director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. Esham Taylor is the founding executive director of the D.C. Policy Center, and we're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. How would you describe the environment for businesses in Washington? Do you think the D.C. Council needs to chill for a bit on legislation that could affect the ability of businesses to prosper? 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Yeshim, what would you say to the argument that so many people seem to be doing well in the district right now? There are cranes everywhere. The big waterfront development is about to open. Why should the council take a break on doing what it can to make sure that workers benefit from that boom?
The workers are benefiting from that boon to the extent that they are able to get jobs in the district. And yes, our job growth has been strong, but our job destruction has been strong as well. Every 25 new job opening in the city, 24 of them goes to make up for a job loss in some other establishment in the city. And we have been not doing so well on this front. The churn rates among businesses is increasing. Business survival rates are low, lower than the nation, and they're getting lower as well. And while we're creating jobs, we're also killing a lot of jobs. And these tell me that there are signs of distress in the city. And to also keep in mind, going back to what Ed said, that it doesn't seem like anybody is being hurt by these legislation. A lot of people work minimum wage jobs in the district. In fact, that has been the growth. And district residents used to hold the largest share of these minimum wage jobs, but increasingly they are moving out to the suburbs. So we're not able to retain workers who work in low-paying jobs.
So you're making the argument that raising the minimum wage is causing businesses to cut back on minimum wage workers. Ed, what lessons should local D.C. lawmakers take out of how the minimum wage experiments have gone in other places? A lot was made of that study on Seattle's minimum wage this summer that found that a hike there may have been doing more harm than good. That minimum wage workers, as a result of it, were apparently working less hours and they weren't being employed as much.
So just to be clear, I think Yeshim wasn't saying that the minimum wage was killing jobs, but it was making harder for D.C. residents to compete for those jobs. Is that right, or did I get you wrong?
Well, I said both.
Oh, but okay.
I'm happy to hear your comment on that.
So the vast body of research on the minimum wage says that when those increases happen in moderate rates over time and the district's raising its minimum wage over a 4 or 5 year period, that those tend to have very modest or no impacts on employment at all. The Seattle study was very weird. Its findings were very weird, and even its methods were weird. For example, it excluded 40% of the workforce. So there's been a lot of questions raised about it. Its findings, it even found that raising the minimum wage had a direct impact on increasing the number of jobs that paid more than $19 an hour. It's just not logical. That's the kind of research that academics look at and say, let's see if we can replicate that or if there was something wrong with that. So I'm not sure that the Seattle study is actually telling us anything, and that the long history of studies about the minimum wage is that it raises people's incomes, and it raises incomes particularly for women and for single moms, and it doesn't tend to reduce jobs.
Well, the advantage the study had is that this is the study that the city of Seattle asked for and the University of Washington provided
it. I'm just making it clear to your listeners that there's been a lot of questions raised about whether this is an anomaly or not.
True that. Your turn, Yeshim.
The Seattle study is one of the many examples that show some of the impacts are not, some people may be benefiting from minimum wage jobs, not everybody benefits. And the lowest skilled workers of all are the ones that will most likely lose. Another study that came out in San Francisco looked at the impacts of the minimum wage increase to $15 in that city and found that second-tier restaurants are more likely to close as a result of the minimum wage. It didn't seem to affect those who can hire from those restaurants that get 5-star ratings, but 3-star, 2-star, 1-star ratings, they did their survival rates declined. And guess who works in those restaurants? It's not the graduates of high-end culinary schools. It's the lowest income, lowest skilled employees.
And it's totally worth looking at. And I wouldn't want to dismiss the notion that when you're asking businesses to change how they do business or how much they pay their workers, that it might have an impact. But it's just careful to look at. And I do think we need to look at what's happening in D.C. and follow that carefully. We don't have any scientific studies yet. But what we looked at, for example, found that in the last 2 years, the workers who saw the biggest increase in wages in the city were the people at the lowest end of the wage scale, which, believe me, has not been the trend over the last 20 or 30 years. And that's when we started raising our minimum wage. So at least the initial findings in the district don't show any sign that people are losing out.
If I may jump in, that only shows you that you can explain it by saying we've really improved the lives of people who get paid low. Or you could just say we used to have a lot of high-paying jobs and we can't grow as fast there anymore. So it may be one or the other. But Kojo, I think...
Or maybe both.
Or both. But I think the real issue, I think the business community supports the moratorium because they see it as finally some acknowledgement from the city council that all of the regulations are essentially pushing all these costs on the businesses. Transportation Equity Act, the businesses can pay a $1,200 penalty. No, what's the big deal? They can eat it up. Paid leave, we'll turn it into a mandate. The businesses can eat it up. Minimum wage, they'll just eat it up. But it's not the businesses that pay taxes. As our good friends in state and tax policy world will tell us, that it's either the owners of the businesses or the consumers or the workers. One of those will pay the taxes. And I think what frustrates the business community is the notion that we can just eat this up. What's the big deal? Businesses can improve lives. Businesses can do this, that, and pay taxes.
But let me quote Ari Schwartz, who was quoted in the Post, who was characterized as a leader for the pro-labor coalition DC Jobs with Justice. I don't understand how anyone can rule out considering things that people need and policies that are going to help people on some arbitrary timeline just because the business community is up in arms, as they always are. It would appear to this individual that even though everyone agrees that the city has been doing well during the course of the past decade, businesses have been doing well during the course of the past decade, that they invariably find something to complain about, even as they seem to be expanding.
There is a pie out there and everyone wants to protect their share. I agree with that. But to say that this is arbitrary, I think it's pushing it. If you look at the legislative history in the District of Columbia, the size of our government has grown much faster than many other places. Government spending is important. I mean, we have a lot of needs that we need to address, but it's not like people are not paying taxes. The district government has one of the most progressive tax systems in the world, one of the strongest affordable housing programs, one of the strongest homeless policies. Our TANF benefits have recently been changed, as we discussed the last time around. So it's not like businesses are just complaining all the time. They are actually contributing quite a bit to the tax base.
But the sticky issue of scheduling employees, because Laverne in Washington would like to talk about that. Laverne, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I'm not sure exactly what is meant by the best interest of the business. But my concern is that businesses, regardless of whether they're small businesses or large institutions, they seem to have no longer any regard for their employees and the lives of these employees outside of work. They can now schedule someone to come in at 3 p.m. one evening, 5 o'clock the next morning, and 11 p.m. the next day. And they have no respect or concern about what kind of private life that person has. Their children, who may have to be at school in the morning, at the bus stop by themselves in the morning. Regardless of what happens, the business comes first, and the law seems to support this.
We got an email from Eric who writes, I'm a shift employee, and I've quit employers due to unpredictable schedules. My best bosses have been able to provide a schedule at least 2 weeks in advance. My worst bosses have sent schedule days or even hours before shifts have started. Not surprisingly, those bosses have had other huge problems with their businesses, from neglected maintenance to managers routinely stealing from them without their awareness. If you can't get a schedule out in a timely manner, you probably have much bigger problems that need to be addressed with your business.
So, Kojo, that is what we're talking about when you say fair scheduling law, is just making sure that the largest businesses in the city, the largest restaurants and the largest retailers, give their workers their schedule 2 weeks in advance. I mean, imagine not knowing each day or each week what you're going to work, when you have to arrange childcare, when you might be wanting to go to school to get a better job, when you're looking for a second job. You can't take a second job if you don't know what your schedule is. And all that's being asked for in this fair scheduling legislation is that workers have that predictability.
And I notice you mentioned the larger businesses. I guess, mm-hmm. Yashim, you would say that it has an adverse effect, especially on the smaller businesses.
It has an adverse effect on people who do work in what people call formula retail. Essentially, we have a handful of large retail establishments in the city. There are not that many of them. And they do hire a disproportionately large number of employees as well. They tend to hire more often part-time workers and more often students. There are businesses that are not good at managing their employees. I don't know in these two cases whether they're talking about a small business or a big business. But this legislation goes after businesses that actually have the capacity of having more consistency in schedules rather than less consistency. The smaller the businesses, the smaller will be their margins and the harder it will be for them to change scheduling behavior.
But just to be clear, the reason I mentioned large businesses is that the legislation that's been introduced to the DC Council only affects large companies that have multiple locations.
Well, it's time for the politics of this. First, you, Ed Lazier, do you think that this moratorium proposed by the council chairman will stand?
I don't really know what a moratorium means, so I don't know if it will stand. I know that the council has to work through paid family leave legislation. So we passed a law, but there are now already bills to repeal and replace it, and in my opinion, replace it with something that's much worse for working families. So we'll Everyone has said we need to work through those bills first, and then we'll see what happens in the next election, or next year. It's an election year, so I would assume that there will be a lot of competition to say who can do the most to make sure that D.C. residents are benefiting from a growing economy. So I don't know that
yes,
the moratorium is over.
Yes, Taylor, what does this moratorium proposal mean to you in practical terms? What do you hope will happen?
Well, I rarely agree with Ed, but in this case, I will agree with him because we still – we have a hearing on the transportation benefits bill on Monday. The paid leave legislation obviously continues. So in practice, this really hasn't done anything. I think the council should consider it as a strategy, but also consider what kind of questions they have to ask about the distributional effects of bills that they're discussing before even passing it. We do fiscal impact statements, we do economic impact statements on large legislation, but we don't do the distributional impact analyses. And I think if they were to think about it more carefully, they'll see that a lot of the business regulation also hurt the type of people the council says they care about.
You know, if I can just put in one comment that I forgot to mention earlier, is that there's only been one economic analysis of the paid family leave legislation, and it found it would have zero impact on DC's economy, that it wouldn't slow us down at all. So it's another example that doing good by workers can actually be fine for business as well.
Ed Lazier, he is the director of the DC Fiscal Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us. Yashim Taylor is the founding executive director of the DC Policy Center, a different organization. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll meet the new director of the National Symphony Orchestra. I'm Kojo Nandi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.